You're about to enter into a new world of knowledge, curiosities, and high strangeness. This is a podcast of Straight Up Strange Productions.
You're listening to Mysteries and Monsters. I'm your host, Paul Bestel. This week, we go on a globe-trotting monster hunt in the company of our good friend, Richard Freeman, covering some cryptids that I've never really dove into before. We head to Africa on the trail of the legendary Macaulay Mbembe, an alleged population of dinosaurs, somehow surviving into the modern era. South America is then our next stop, as we chase down the giant ground sloth, which still keeps being reported by witnesses around the Amazon basin. Mongolia is our third stop, as we hunt for its notorious and deadly death worm, said to lurk across the Gobi Desert, a creature whose reputation is so deadly, entire groups will up sticks and move away from its presence. Our final destination takes us out searching for Russia's Yeren, a cryptid which doesn't take kindly to aggression from humans, but seems to have a passion for the local cheese. As always, before we go out hunting some of the world's strangest cryptids, don't forget you can support Mysteries and Monsters by signing up for Patreon. You can find the site at patreon.com/mysteriesandmonsters or click on the link in the show notes as always. $4 a month gets you ad-free episodes, early releases, and this month there will be some super bonus content as well. A big thank you to my two latest Patreons, Frank and Elaine. And as always, thank you to each and every one of you for your support. It means a lot. Thank you again. Mysteries and Monsters is across all social media platforms, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, LinkedIn, and please subscribe to the Mysteries and Monsters YouTube channel. You can find news, episodes, merchandise, and more by also going to mysteriesandmonsters.com, the website. A big thank you as always to Dean Bestel for his marvellous artwork. The show is produced by Brennan Stahl of the Ghost Story Guys, and Mysteries and Monsters is delighted to be a part of the Straight Up Strange network. Cryptids exist across the entire world, and Richard Freeman takes us around it in the search for real monsters.
On today's show, it's another long overdue return to Mysteries and Monsters for our good friend Richard Freeman. Richard's latest book, In Search of Real Monsters, is the second volume of his adventures in cryptozoology, and the series takes us on the hunt for more mysterious monsters. With in-depth analysis of some cryptozoological conundrums, his latest book is a treasure trove of delights. Richard, welcome back. Fifth appearance.
Yeah, nice to be back again. Must be some sort of record, 5, mustn't it?
Yes, you're certainly up there, you and David Weatherly. I'm going to have to start thinking of a prize I can give you. So I'll have to put my thinking caps on, Richard, and see what I can come up with. But delighted to finally welcome you back. It's one of those things that it seems like ages since we've spoke, though it's probably not really, because we do speak a lot regardless.
Yeah, I mean, it can't be that long. What was the last one I did? Was it Dragon? Was that the last one I did, or was the one after that?
I think it was probably... It's one of those things, because I do episodes now, and I look back, and I think... Because I've recently just spoken again with Malcolm Robinson, who's going to be an upcoming episode. And Malcolm was actually one of the very first interviews I did, and it was 2.5 years. It was crazy. Because I've seen him in real life since then.
Yeah.
So, yeah, these things just sneak up on you, mate. But I'm glad to hear that you survived the latest weird weekend festival that's just occurred.
It was fantastic. Possibly the best one I've ever been. Wonderful. A lard-eating competition, a quiz with prizes that included a... songs with my face on and the legend Good One Roger written above them. Fantastic attendance, great speakers for the most part, and It was a huge success.
Excellent. What was your talk on Richard this year?
My talk this year was on the trip I took to Garrow Hills in Meghalaya in northeast India in search of the Yeti.
Mmm, fabulous.
I'm back out. Yeah, I'm back out later in the year. Last 3 weeks in August, looks like I'll be going out to Sumatra again for my sixth expedition to look for the Barang Pernet.
Oh, fantastic. That all confirmed and booked in then, Rich?
Yeah, pretty much.
Oh, brilliant. Oh, I look forward to that. So I'll definitely be picking your brains towards the end of the year when you return then, and hopefully with some cataclysmic evidence.
Oh, God, that would be wonderful. If we can prove it exists, that would be absolutely fantastic.
Absolutely, absolutely. I mean, your new book, obviously, is the second part, as we said, to your Adventures in Cryptozoology, which, did that come out, 3 years ago now, 4 years?
The COVID, like it stymied everything else, stymied this. The book originally was only supposed to be one volume, but it was so long that Mango Publishing wanted me to bring it out in two parts. So this was the second part. I just arbitrarily cut the book in two, and it ended up being in two sections rather than one.
Well, I don't think it does anything negatively, really, because I think both books, when you put them together, obviously for someone like me, Richard, the larger the book is never a problem, unless I'm sort of trying to read them in bed, which can often give you arm strain, I think.
Yes.
So for somebody like me, it's perfect that we've got these two books that we can read as companion pieces together. So for me, when you were making that decision about how you were going to sort of cut it down the middle, had you already decided that this second volume was going to be the latter part of that book in its original format?
Yeah, I literally just measured it roughly halfway through and cut it in two.
Well, I suppose that shows the quality of the book, because as I said before we started the interview proper, I love it. I think it's probably the best piece of work that you've released, and I'm a big fan of your work both in the field and your writing, Richard. So I just, maybe it's because there are some cases in this one that I've not really had a real chance to dive into before on the show properly. One of them is a creature that a lot of people find extremely controversial. And I think we'll start with that one when we get going. But obviously you've covered two or three different sections. So for anybody who's not aware of the book or looking to pick it out, how have you broke this second volume down for people, Richard?
Well, it's broken down into four sections, really. There are creatures that are thought to be extinct but might still be around, such as the Tasmanian wolf, giant ground sloth, the supposed surviving dinosaurs in Africa. Then there is a section on giant animals, giant crocodiles, giant pythons, giant anacondas and so forth, which we covered on the show before, if I remember.
Yep.
And then the biggest part of the book really is about my own adventures, going around the world on a trail of things like the Orang Pendek, the giant anaconda, the Tasmanian wolf, the Mongolian death worm, the Yeti, the El Masti, things like that. And then the final chapter, I just give some advice on setting your own expedition up. If you want to go out there into the field, how to do it from scratch and what the best advice is.
Absolutely. I think that's one of those things that often gets overlooked these days. I think people just presume that the generation that are out there at the minute are going to carry on forever, Richard, which, you know, I hope everybody keeps going as long as they can. But obviously, there is that need for young blood and fresh eyes to be out in the field in a variety of continents looking for some of these wonderful creatures. Because, you know, as you say, you're hopefully going out to Sumatra on the hunt for the Orang Pendek towards the end of this year. You know, these are far-flung places. These expeditions do take it out of you, both physically and mentally, I would imagine.
Yes, they do. I mean, there was one guy once who accused the CSZ of just doing this because they want expensive foreign holidays. Well, the kind of expensive foreign holidays where I've been stalked by tigers, attacked by cobras, fallen off cliffs, fallen down ice crevasses, nearly got swept away by rapids, been covered in ticks, been covered in leeches, the 100 of them, have violent explosive dysentery that lasted for 5 weeks. Been completely exhausted.
Yeah.
Had to put up with the crappiest food you can imagine. And I hate camping. I camp up on these expeditions because it's necessary to camp in the wilderness, but I don't like it. I hate it. I never get a good night's sleep under canvas. It's monstrously uncomfortable. It's cold. It gives you piles. Some people do this for bloody pleasure. Why anyone would go camping for pleasure is utterly beyond me.
Yeah. You're not really selling it to me, Richard, but I appreciate you taking the time to put yourself out there on my behalf often. I think one of the aspects of the book that I was enjoyed reading more about is, as I touched on a moment ago, probably one of the most controversial creatures in the world of cryptozoology. And often people might say, oh, are you talking about Bigfoot or the Yeti? But for me, there's one creature that really seems to be one of those things that what I know about the search for this creature now compared to what I thought I knew 5 years ago, Richard, has really changed my opinion and opened my eyes a lot. And that is, of course, Mekele Mbembe, which is the alleged lost dinosaur that is supposed to exist in Africa. Especially a lot of people, there are two or three places that people suspect that this creature lives. So for anybody who's not aware of this wonderfully legendary creature, can you give us a sort of crash course in what is supposed to be going on in these parts of Africa that people are searching for this creature?
Well, this is an animal that's reported from the Congo and the surrounding rainforest, Democratic Republic of Congo, the Congo, and the surrounding countries like Cameroon and places like that. And it has different names, different places, but Mekele Mbembe means he who dams the river. And it's supposed to be so large that it can stop the flow of a river or dam the flow of a river. The creature is reported as being about the size of an elephant with a long, powerful, muscular tail, four legs, a long neck and a crest running down the neck. It's sort of a reddy brown in colour. And some reports say the male bears a horn on its head. Now, this has been reported ever since the time of the German colonists. And people have seized on this animal and tried to say that it's a surviving sauropod dinosaur. Sauropod dinosaurs were the long-necked herbivorous dinosaurs like Brachiosaurus, Diplodocus, Brontosaurus, and so on. And back in Victorian days, when the bones were first unearthed, they thought that these animals were too big to walk around on land, that they spent most of their time in the water, being buoyed up by the water and eating the soft water plants, and they would only come out onto land to breed and lay eggs.
Mm.
Now we know this is not true. They had thick, powerful, tree-trunk-like legs, and they walked around on land. We know this from the footprints. We know that their teeth were used for nipping off fibrous material from trees and other plants. They had a gizzard, a muscular gizzard like birds, and they'd swallow stones and use the stones to mush up and grind up the plant material that they ate. Mm. If they were living in water, they would have to be drawing water from the surface down necks of 30 feet or more in length, and the water pressure would cause the lungs to collapse.
Yeah.
So they couldn't have lived in water. So they moved around in herds on land like elephants or giraffes. So Mekele Mbembe, whatever it is highly unlikely to be a sauropod dinosaur because, because they didn't live in water. They've been extinct for 65 million years and there's nothing in the fossil record to suggest that they survived.
Yes. Now, my first introduction to this creature was, once again, and I'm sure some of my regular listeners will be surprised I've not mentioned this show for a while, which was Arthur C. Clarke's Mysterious World. And they had an interview with Roy McCall and Richard Greenwell, I think, who were off on their trip out on the search of this. And this was my first ever introduction as a young person. Richard, to this creature's alleged existence. But as you point out in your chapter that focuses on this, there has been numerous stories coming out sort of most of the early 20th century. Primarily, there is this rather tragic story of one of the most famous early expeditions, which I believe was a gentleman called Captain Lester Stevens and his famous dog Laddie, who was some kind of war hero due to his bravery in the trenches during the First World War, which has a really sad ending, does it not?
Well, he vanished in the African jungles. He'd heard these stories about, quote-unquote, a brontosaurus living in the jungles of Africa, and he'd gone off with his dog to search for it, and that was the last anybody heard of him, whether he was killed by disease or eaten by a crocodile or what happened to him, nobody knows. A bit like Percy Fawcett in South America. He went off into the wilderness and he just vanished.
That's the kind of thing that creates more legends than you would imagine as well, Richard, because as soon as something like this happens, people go, oh, now then, now we've got another mystery on top of this. But I think you were saying in the chapter, the story that kind of encouraged him to go out there looks like it was a hoax anyway. It just looked like somebody who didn't know much about dinosaurs had just made something up.
It was a newspaper hoax, yes. The original description was something more like a Tyrannosaurus rex. It was a large predatory creature that came out of a swamp and was eating a dead rhinoceros.
Mm.
And there was a picture of what seemed to be a Komodo dragon superimposed onto the body of a dead rhinoceros, an enlarged Komodo dragon. But they were all newspaper hoaxes, some of the early stories. And then, but the early explorers, what they were hearing from the Pygmies, the native peoples, was something quite different. They were talking about this long-necked animal that lived in the water, not this bipedal predator. And there were expeditions sent to look for this thing, thinking that it was an actual sauropod dinosaur.
So do you think, because I think obviously this period of history, there seems to have been a real explosion. Obviously dinosaurs were becoming extremely popular. You have the sort of one of the first major cinema hits of the 1920s, which is The Lost World, which is obviously about a group of explorers that discover a secret population of dinosaurs still living in the modern age. Do you think that this was this kind of situation where big game hunters and institutes like the Smithsonian had thought there's got to be more to this than meets the eye, and they just kind of ran with it? Or do you just think that this seems to have started off as some kind of hoax that got out of hand, Richard?
Well, the Smithsonian was fairly sceptical about it all along. The newspaper stories were certainly hoaxes, but there were native accounts of some large, strange animal living in the Congo. And it wasn't just Mokelian Membe. There was another creature called a Melanotoca, the killer of elephants, that was supposed to have a great horn on its head, and it bore hippopotamus and elephants to death. And some people were thinking that this was some sort of ceratopsian dinosaur. The group that included Triceratops and Styracosaurus and Semprosaurus. But in some areas, they were thinking that there was more than one animal. Like in Lake Bangalolo, the creature in Lake Bangalolo was supposed to have a great horn on its head, which it used to gore hippopotamus with.
I mean, I've often found this quite interesting. When we look at cryptozoology over the history of the 20th century, Richard, I'm always really surprised that for some reason all these, I know obviously there are stories of mega lizards in Australia and things, but Africa really seems to be the continent where these lost dinosaurs are supposed to live. Do you have a theory as to why Africa seemed to be generating these stories in the sort of 1920s, 1930s? Because I think there was another one called the Chipekwe, that was supposed to be some kind of giant lizard that was wandering around as well.
Yeah, Chipekwe is more or less, it's another local name for Mokelian Membe. There were things in other countries. There was what was supposed to be a tyrannosaur living in the Australian outback that was called Urulijur. And then there was some stories from South America of a thing that sounded superficially like sauropods, but Africa was the main place for it. And I think very much because it was the original heart of darkness. It was a place that was, at the time, had been carved up by European countries and was still largely unexplored. And we were discovering new things about the dinosaurs, all at the time in the 20s or the 30s. The Lost World was published, and there was the film, The Lost World. And before that, the original dinosaur film was The Ghost of Slumber Mountain, which was an original silent, which you can see on YouTube. It's in all its entirety. Because I think it was a combination of these things. And the jungles of the Congo were still the most ill-explored jungles on Earth. I think it's a mixture of lack of exploration and mystery and the fascination with dinosaurs.
Mm. And it does seem as well that every time you think this story at that period drops off the map, somebody else seems to turn up, because after we've had Captain Stevens and his dog disappearing, and then the Smithsonian claiming that they weren't there looking for dinosaurs at all, and they got quite upset that anybody would be accusing them of doing such trivialities. You still had other people coming out there, preachers and people who'd been out there on as missionaries, Richard, claiming that people had said this. And then somebody bumped in, as if by chance. It's one of those weird things that occasionally happens with stories like this, that an author bumped into a bedraggled-looking man who was actually quite a well-travelled man, who was called Alfred Smith. And Smith, once again, seemed to have lit a fire once again under this story and brought it back into the public's attention.
He's this old tramp that walked up this woman's drive one day, selling gridirons, and she asked him in for tea, and he told her his life story. He was an Englishman, and he'd gone to a public school, was always getting into trouble. Then after school, he went and joined a trading company in Africa and spent his life having adventures in Africa, going up and down unexplored rivers. And they wrote books about him, and they even made a film in the 30s about him called Trader Horn. It used to be on YouTube. I think it's been taken down. But if you can find this film, because apart from the real Trader Horn, the film in itself is a legend. It was the first major film to be actually filmed in Africa rather than in studios pretending it was Africa.
Yeah.
During the filming of it, one of their extras was eaten by a crocodile. Another was gored to death by a rhinoceros. Hippos trampled their camp. The director told the actors to climb up a tree and then put meat around the tree to attract lions so he could get a shot of it, took up a tree with lions around them. The leading lady got malaria, and it finished her career because she had malaria for 6 years and couldn't act, and everyone thought she was dead.
No.
So the film itself is a legend, never mind the real Trader Hall. It's so worth seeing. It's an early talkie, and it's great. It's absolutely fantastic. But Trader Hall, he never saw the Mekelle Mbembe's, but he heard about it, and he saw the great three-toed tracks. Now, here's another thing. Sauropod dinosaurs, their tracks are very rounded, and you can barely see the toes because most of the toes are covered by sheets of skin.
Mm.
So the toes didn't protrude except for one hooked toe on some species that they used for biting.
Mm.
So these three-toed tracks are completely unlike anything a sauropod would leave. Now, I've seen an alleged dinosaur track reproduced in a photograph, and it looked to me like the track of a rhinoceros.
Mm.
Now, a Melanotoka, the killer of elephants, sounds very much like a rhinoceros rather than a ceratopsian dinosaur. A big white rhinoceros could easily gore a hippo to death with its massive horn that can weigh 5 tons, and the head alone weighed as much as a dairy cow. Now, African rhinos are creatures of the plains. They live in grassland. Asian rhinos live in rainforests. And the Asian species spend much more time in water than the African ones do. Now, there were a prehistoric group of rhinos that lived a lifestyle more like hippos. They spent a lot of their time in water. So it could be that the Melanotoka is an undiscovered species of rhino that is semi-aquatic.
Mm.
It could be a descendant of this prehistoric group of rhinos, or it could just be distorted memories from when the area was more open and rhinos inhabited the area. And as for Makeli and Mbembe, I think it's a combination of things. Some of it is purely folkloric. There's one story about Makeli and Mbembe helping a tribe of people when they were being attacked by their enemies. It formed itself into a living bridge and the people went across it. That's clearly folkloric. There could be some huge species of semi-aquatic monitor lizard. A lot of them, monitor lizards that live in water, like the Asian water monitor and the Nile monitor, tend to have relatively long necks, as opposed to those that live on land, like Bosk's monitor and the Komodo dragon and things. So we know that Megalania in Australia, or as they're calling it now, Varanus priscus, but I still prefer the old name Megalania, which is more evocative. I mean, that could be, you know, anywhere between 23 to 30 feet long. Could there be a giant undiscovered species of semi-aquatic monitor in the Congo? And also you've got to remember, people might be seeing immense polychons lifting their head and neck up out of the water, and they're going to stake it for the head and neck of a dinosaur-like animal. Or the long-necked turtles, the long-necked soft-shelled turtles, and some of those can grow to immense sizes. And seen at a distance with a long neck out of the water, it could be mistaken for a dinosaur.
Yeah.
But there are dinosaurs in the Congo. There are thousands of species of dinosaur in the Congo, and they all have feathers and they tweet.
Of course. I mean, this is one of those things that I'm still surprised more people don't realise, Richard, that obviously birds are the closest living relative to dinosaurs.
I know you mentioned. They're not just related, they are literally dinosaurs in every sense of the word.
Yeah.
So when you're eating chicken, you're a man-eating dinosaur.
And I know you point out in the book, a chicken is, or a duck is more closely related to a Tyrannosaurus rex than a Triceratops was.
Oh, much more closely related. Upright stance, these pneumatic bones, they all develop from theropod dinosaurs.
Yeah. So when it comes to dinosaurs in Africa, and Makeli and Mbembe obviously is the most famous member of this group.
Yeah.
Why did it kind of just disappear again after the Second World War? Because it's one of those things, Rich, that obviously there's lots of things going on in the 20s and 30s, as we've mentioned. And, a couple of people mention it sort of late 40s, early 50s, and then nothing seems to happen until Mikkel goes out there at the beginning of the 80s. And obviously at the time, I think he was the vice president of the International Society for Cryptozoology, along with another gentleman who I think was a crocodilian expert, James Powell?
Yes. He was the guy that had that fantastic wig. Do you remember that? Across a serious world. That terrible syrup on his head.
I'm glad you've mentioned that, Richard, because that's troubled me for a long time, because I'm thinking, surely I can't be the only person that realises that's one of the worst wigs I've ever seen.
God knows what it was like in the tropical heat.
I was thinking that when he was going. I was thinking, I hope he's not wearing that when he gets out there, because he's going to be sweating buckets. It was like he got somebody's cat on his head.
It was, yeah. God knows what the pig meat's for.
So why? I mean, this is the thing about Makeli and Mbembe. Why does it keep coming back, Richard? I know, obviously, in the last 20 years, it's been seized upon by creationists, which is a very niche strand of cryptozoology, and that, you know, they've kind of,
they do so much more damage to cryptozoology than anything else. They damage its credibility because they are so critical. They believe everything, and they've got an axe to grind. You see, they're not going out there to try and prove the animal exists or look for evidence for it. They're going out there because they think if they can find it, it'll prove their young Earth creationist theories. Which it wouldn't, even if there was a living dinosaur in the Congo, a living non-avian dinosaur, I should say. It wouldn't prove the Earth was only 6,000 years old, or that God made it all, or anything like that. It's totally illogical. And these idiots tend to get lots and lots of money because they're backed by religious organisations that will send them out looking for dinosaurs in the Congo, when that money could have been spent elsewhere in the cryptozoological field doing something much better.
Yeah.
Now, I would go and look for, if it was being paid for, if I could afford it, I would go and look for Makeli and Mbembe in a heartbeat. I'd love to do it. I'd love to visit the Congo. But I don't think you're going to find a non-avian dinosaur there.
Yeah. I think it's one of those things as well, like you say, the argument that it disproves evolution, I personally think shows a complete lack of understanding of what evolution is. Because if you find a dinosaur, then that's a dinosaur. It doesn't mean anything else other than the fact that it survived whatsoever.
No.
And it's remarkable how having that kind of mindset, basically you're looking for something that proves your point, whereas finding it would be, you know, if anybody found one, it would be incredible. But it doesn't disprove evolution in the slightest. I mean, Darren Naish, I remember hearing him speak about this a couple of years ago. Someone asked him about this in a newspaper. I think it was The Guardian. And he was saying, you know, he doubts that there's any truth to any of these stories. And a lot of it is leg pulling of people coming to the areas and the locals just taking the Michael out of them a lot. And some of it is misidentification and people who've no idea about animal footprints or anything. Richard, as you've said earlier on about what you've seen and what you think it is. So it's one of those where we seem to have a real mess of sort of origins for this creature that nobody can seem to pin it down. There's about five different descriptions of it. And as you say, if you look at the evidence and the common sense approach, this sounds like some kind of unknown species of rhino more than anything else.
Yeah. I've got a lot of it is folkloric. It's all been mixed up together into one sort of grey mush.
Mm.
And it's hard to pick out, you know, well, you can see what comes from legend. There's more absurd stories. But,
Yeah.
You know, it's not just native people that claim to have seen it. You know, Westerners claim to have seen strange things there as well. I'm sure there's something at the bottom of it. There's some unknown animal there at the bottom of this. Maybe more than one, probably. Mm. But I don't think any of them are dinosaurs.
Yeah. And obviously there are a lot of people, even in the modern cryptozoological field, who believe there is something to this, Richard, as you say, because I tend to think that whatever this is, it's some kind of unknown creature. I'm not even going to speculate what type it is, because it could be something that we've never really come across, other than in the fossil record, perhaps. You only have to look 100 years ago to see the stories of people talking about the Komodo dragon was supposed to be fanciful nonsense. And we obviously know that it took one to be killed for it to be finally proven. And yet here we, you know, you have a giant lizard that is a horrific hunter and can cause serious damage, you know, and quite happily feast on people if it gets the opportunity. So it's not beyond the realms of possibility that this could be some kind of unknown species of mammal or reptile that is either very good at hiding or just doesn't like being around people. So when you see people like Roy McCall and James Powell, and obviously Adam Davis has gone out there as well, clearly people think there is something to this, but it's probably not some kind of dinosaur.
Yeah, so at the end of the final analysis, as it stands within it, it's probably something in the Congo we don't understand. But I would bet my love spuds that it's not a dinosaur.
Well, there's a challenge for the world of cryptozoology, Richard.
And Darren Naish would be a good guy to have get on at some time, because he's a pretty open-minded fellow.
Yeah, he's on my list to get to speak to by the end of this year, I have to say. I'm impressed with Darren. He's balancedly sceptical, and I like that. And he's got a lot of good things to say. So he's a good one, yeah. So let's jump across the Atlantic then, Richard, to another controversial creature, because this one seems to be one of those, in my opinion anyway, correct me if I'm wrong, that seems to have really caught fire in the last sort of 10 or 15 years in regards to people. I've actually seen people put this creature forward as the reason people see Bigfoot and Sasquatch, which I find ludicrous, to be honest. But this is the South American giant ground sloth, Richard.
Yeah, once again, we know that these existed. Ground sloths were a big group. There were lots of different types of them. The biggest of them were Megalotherium and Molotherium, which were the size of Asian elephants. But right down to ones that were the size of large dogs. Most of them were about the size of bears. I lived all over South America, and when the Isthmus of Panama was formed, when the two continents came together, they They were quite successful in North America, but they were an exchange of fauna from North and South America. They both, the stuff from North America came down, some of the things from South America went up. Like the killer birds, the Prothrakids, the giant flightless killer birds, they invaded North America as well. And the ground goats went right the way up to Alaska.
Mm.
They were immensely successful. Now, they were supposed to have died out relatively recently, between 10 and 8,000 years ago. But there's a theory that some of these things, one of the medium-sized ones, is still around in the rainforests of the Amazon. And the people call it the Mapinguari, and they say that it has, it's a great shaggy beast that can move on all fours, can stand up and walk on its hind legs, it has great hooked claws and a foul smell, and it makes a bellowing roar that sounds like the engine of a jet. And the local people say its hide cannot be pierced by arrows except on the belly. Now, there is a type of ground sloths called Mylodons, and they had unique skin that was studded with nodules of bone. It would have made it very hard to be pierced. It was sort of subcutaneous armor. The only place they didn't have it was on the belly.
Mm.
It was a bit of a coincidence. So there's an ornithologist called David Orrin, who's been on the trail of these things for years and years. And there are occasional sightings of that huge, hairy animal with great claws lumbering through the jungles of South America. And these go back to colonial times. And they're quite different from the ape-like creatures, like the Didi, reported in South America, which sound more like Sasquatch or a Yeti. And then there are smaller ones, the smaller ape-like creatures. But the Mapinguari is totally different to any of them, because it has a great side-like claws and it hasn't got this man-like face. So it's a different kettle of fish altogether. And we're not talking about something like non-avian dinosaurs that died out 55 million years ago. We're talking about something that died out maybe 8,000 years ago, which is the blink of an eye in evolutionary terms. So it's not impossible that something like this is still around. Now, the evidence for it is not good. As it stands, there are some alleged footprints, and it's mainly eyewitness accounts.
Mm.
But it's something we shouldn't necessarily reject out of hand. And it would be interesting to take a closer look at. It's not anything like my top five that I think actually exist, but it's an intriguing possibility.
Mm. What do you think attracted Orrin to this? Because as you say, Orrin's an ornithologist, isn't he? Do you think it was because the amount of people he'd met that claimed to have seen this creature? Because, I mean, the other aspect of all this, Richard, is a lot of these sightings seem to come from the Brazilian area of the Amazon, which even for most people, there's a lot of the Amazon that is still untouched or unexplored. Clearly, there are lost civilizations still out there. I think people have come across tribes still that have never experienced contact with the outside world within the last 20 years that are clearly still living out there in the Amazon rainforest. There are tributaries of the river that run for hundreds of miles left, right, and center. For me, the possibility of unknown creatures being still in the Amazon seems like it's patently sensible to me.
Oh, yes, definitely. And they don't have to be small ones.
Hmm?
I mean, recently we've discovered a new species of tapir. The Dutch scientists who found a new species of tapir. An animal as big as a donkey in the Amazon.
Hmm?
A new species of manatee has been found in the Amazon, a kidney manatee. Lots of different species of monkeys. So it's one of those places like Indonesia. It's a hotbed of biological diversity and discovery.
Absolutely. And I know a lot of people are saying one of the other aspects of these ground sloths is a lot of the witnesses and stories that come out about these is that they're both nocturnal and they live in burrows, which straight away kind of gives these creatures an advantage, one would suspect, if they are there.
Absolutely, yeah. Yeah, if you're moving around at night, you've got less chance of being seen. I mean, most people think that Sasquatch moves around mainly at night. That's how it's avoided competition with modern man.
I mean, it is one that there are more recent reports of this as well, when we're comparing it to aquatic dinosaurs living in Africa. You know, when we're talking about some of these witnesses who have claimed to have encountered the sloth, we can find cases and witnesses from the last 20 years, can't we?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Mind you, Adam Davis, when he went over there, went to the Congo, he was talking to people that had claimed to have seen the Kelly and then they were to release them to
him. Mm. So, yeah, it's tantalizing, like you say, because I think the fact that it's more recent in the fossil record, and we've got these incredible burrows that occasionally do the rounds on online, Richard, when somebody writes an article or shares these pictures, which are incredible things when you look at it. And as with anything like that, one of the first things is I wouldn't like to bump into whatever's dug there because they are enormous. They look like mine shafts.
Yeah, and they excavate these with a whacking great claw they got, which was also used for tearing down vegetation and fighting off from predators. And there's some evidence that they also ate meat as well. The bulk of the diet would have been vegetation.
Mm.
There's some evidence now to suggest looking at isotopes in their teeth and things and their bones, that they included in their diet a certain amount of meat that they would have probably got from carrion.
Mm.
Now, that sounds bizarre, but both are closely related to armadillos.
Mm.
Armadillos eat mainly termite plants and fruit, but did you know they will attack and kill and eat lambs and calves? I had no idea about this. It's something that Darren Nance showed me on his Texapod Zoology website.
Yeah.
It was filmed for South America, I think it was Uruguay, of armadillos quite savagely attacking lambs and calves and chomping into them, which I would never have believed unless I hadn't seen it myself. The farmer was having to pull them off, you know, by the tail with his boots. They were clamped on so voraciously, and it's not something you would expect an armadillo to do.
How strange. How long ago is it since we discovered this then, Richard? Is this a fairly modern...
Very recently, yeah. I mean, the farmers have probably known about it for donkey's years, but...
Yeah.
We only just found out about it pretty recently.
And I suppose that's one of those things where if you get a farmer, we know how these things are, Richard. If you get a farmer saying, armadillos keep attacking my lambs, people are just going to laugh at them.
Mm.
Right.
Or in South America, blame it on the chupacabra.
Well, stranger things have happened, obviously. I mean, that is a remarkable thing. But once again, it shows the adaptability of animals we think we know everything about to change our perceptions when circumstances dictate it. At the end of the day, it is survival of the fittest. Animals will do whatever they can to keep going, won't they?
And they surprise us in their behaviour. I mean, would you believe that parrots can kill sheep?
Can they?
Yeah. There's a type of parrot from New Zealand called the kia, which lives at a high altitude in the mountains. We associate parrots with warm places, but a lot of species are cold adapted. And this New Zealand species called the kia lives in the mountains. So for years, farmers have been saying that they kill sheep. And, you know, quite naturally, everybody thought this was nonsense.
Yes.
Until it was actually filmed with infrared cameras at night. They swooped down onto the back of the sheep and literally start eating it alive. They eat all the fat away from around the liver. They hack into it with their beak, which are immensely powerful. Amazingly powerful beaks for cracking nuts and shearing into things, and the sheep, which can't really defend itself, the parrot clings onto it and hacks into the flesh and eats the fat away around the liver and literally eat the sheep alive.
That's remarkable. Absolutely remarkable. I've never seen that. I'll have to search that footage down. That's both incredibly interesting and terrifying, Richard.
Well, if you look up kias eating sheep or armadillos eating lambs and calves, you'll get it.
Absolutely. I'll have to put some links into the show notes because I don't think people are going to believe us, Richard, but I'm absolutely convinced now. So that's incredible. I mean, these are animals that we think we know everything about, and yet here we have two completely different species turning the perceptions up on their heads.
It's incredible. Yeah. It's what makes you wonder, animals we don't know anything about, cryptids, and if we don't know the behaviour of well-known animals, what chance have we got of understanding cryptids?
Precisely. I think that's a good way to dive into our next creature, because when it comes to strange behaviours and legendary status, and terrifying ability. I don't think much can match the Mongolian death worm, Richard.
It's one of my favourite cryptids. Mongolia is the best place I've ever been, the most amazing alien place I've ever been. I've been on the track of the death worm, and I really want to go back. And the whole thing is fascinating. The natives, the nomads in the Gobi Desert, speak of this creature that they call the Oroi Hoi Hoi, which means infested worm, which is supposed to look like a length of cow's intestine. And they go in very great fear of it. It was first really brought to the attention of the West by Roy Chapman Andrews, who is the guy they based Indiana Jones on. Rather than being an archaeologist, though, he's a paleontologist. He studied fossils. And he went into Mongolia to look for the remains of prehistoric humans, the ancestors of man. What he found instead was fantastic dinosaur fossils, amazing collections of eggs of Protoceratops and Oviraptor. And other dinosaurs like that. But the Mongolian Prime Minister had told him to be on the lookout for the Oroi Hoi Hoi. And he said there was this belief in this worm-like creature that people were terrified of. He didn't believe himself and he never saw one, but he was the first Westerner to mention it. Russian writers before him wrote about that, but the books were never translated. Mongolia was a socialist country up till the 90s. When it opened up, the first guy to get in there and look for the death worm was a Czech cryptozoologist called Ivan Michele, who's a lovely guy. I met him. Sadly, he passed away. He was a brilliant guy. And he went around interviewing people, and he heard stories about this reddish-coloured worm-like creature that would come to the surface after rain, that lived in the most remote parts of the Gobi. It was supposed to be able to generate blasts of electricity. There's one story you heard about a camel trod on one of them and it started to foam at the mouth and collapsed, shaking, and the witnesses saw the death worm crawling away. There was another story about some geologists trying to stick a theodolite into a sand dune, and then the guy started to thrash and kick and fell to the floor dead, and someone saw a death worm crawling away. He didn't see the death worm, but he met loads of people that were seeing it. He did have a terrible nightmare about it, crawling up out of the desert sands, attaching itself to his back like some monstrous leech. Then morning, when he woke up, there was a big blood blister where in his dream the death worm had attached itself to him, and he actually ended up having a heart attack, thankfully surviving. But he was an incredibly intrepid man, and I wished he was still with us, and I wish some of his books were translated into English. But I went over there in 2005, and I travelled for 1,000 miles across the Gobi, which is the most alien place I've ever been. You think of the desert as being sandy, and some parts of the Gobi are sand dunes. There's a place called the Singing Dunes that when the wind starts to blow and the sand starts to move, it sounds like the engine of a plane. But in other places, it looks like the surface of Mars, all rocky and red. In other places, it looks like a giant cat litter tray spread out to infinity. In other places, it's like a mirror. There's a place that actually they call it the mirror because the ground is strewn with chips of mica. And you can travel for days and days and days without seeing a spine of another human being. And then you might come across an old ruined temple in the depths of the desert with the desert winds howling around it in that eerie fashion. And it is so alien and bizarre and empty. The people there are incredibly hospitable and friendly. And we travelled for about 1,000 miles through the Gobi and talked to about 2 dozen witnesses. And their stories all dovetail. They talk about an animal that's roughly the length of your arm, and it's thick, scaly, a reddy brown, and it's hard to tell which end is the tail and which end is the head. It sort of looks like a drastic figure or that's alarming. Most people just see it lying in the desert. We met a couple of people that said they'd seen it grabbing mice, killing and eating mice, and a woman that said she'd seen it slithering in and out of a hole in the desert. But most people just see it stretched out or coiled up as if it's basking in the sun. And they are terrified of it. We talked to one man who said he'd seen it as a boy when he was tending his family's goats and camels. And he told his parents, and they were so frightened, they rallied up all the animals, packed up their gear, which is the circular tent they had, and moved out of the area. A death worm can send a whole area into a panic. Even if they're like a village of gears, if someone sees a death worm, they'll up and move. Now, they say that the electricity, they call it throwing lightning. They say they don't believe that, and they think that's purely folklore. But they believe it's venomous, and it can spit. And its saliva acts like an acid. It can burn. And it has yellow saliva that's corrosive, and things turn green if it spits at them. They'll turn green and die and shrivel. But we found nobody that knew anyone that had been killed by one, or even seen one spitting. The only violent thing anybody saw them doing was killing rodents. So there's one guy who was an old retired colonel we met, and it was at an old outpost near the borders of China, an old military outpost. And he had retired, and there were still families living there because it was like a skeleton crew that lived there. And he said that in the 70s, he'd been driving his motorbike through the desert, and he saw what he thought was a section of fire lying in the desert. And as he got closer, he saw it was the death worm. And it had, he said it had dew on it, because it was early morning, it had dew on it, and the dew was catching the light and sparkling. And he said that's why he thinks the electricity story comes from. It's a sparkling of the dew on its back. Mm. He said it was this scaly cottage shaped thing, and he drove back to camp to get a camera, but of course by the time he got back, it had gone. We talked to one guy who'd seen it in the 1930s, when he was a boy, and he was in his 90s now. And then we'll talk to another guy who'd seen it just the year before, 2004, seen at one of these remote oases. And what I think the death worm is, it's not a worm at all, it's some sort of burrowing reptile. There are a group of reptiles called amphisbaenas, or worm lizards. And these are these bizarre creatures that are not snakes or lizards, but they're related to both of them. And they burrow underground. They spend most of their time underground, and they only occasionally come to the surface. And they're weird-looking things. And they're found in Europe and parts of the Americas and parts of Africa. But none of them recorded from Asia yet. But if you look up the red worm lizard, it looks very like the descriptions of the Mongolian death worm. So I think the Mongolian death worm is possibly a very large undiscovered species of worm lizard, or amphisbaena. Or it's a sand boa. And sand boas are all short, chunky snakes, they're constrictors, only a few feet long, that live in desert areas. Now, I think the powers attributed to the death worm are apocryphal. Bernard Heuvelmann, the father of cryptozoology, called this the mythalization process. And it's where powers are ascribed to an unknown animal just because it's unknown and people are frightened of it.
Mm.
For example, in Somalia, there is a type of sand boa. The local name for it is the apri. And the people there believe it's so venomous, it doesn't even have to bite you. If you touch it, you'll die from absorbing the venom in its body. In fact, it's utterly harmless unless you happen to be a male, because it's not venomous at all.
Mm.
In Pakistan, I believe the tokay gecko, which is a large species of gecko that can, to be fair, give you a fair old nick, but they believe it has the killing power of 20 cobras. They call it the bith adder. I think it's as venomous as 20 cobras. It's not venomous at all. It just comes from ignorance of what the animal is. So I think something similar has happened to the death worm. And I'd love to go back and look for the death worm again, because it's the sort of thing, if you saw one, you could catch it. You could actually catch it physically, put it in a container, bring it back to Ulaanbaatar, the capital, mm-hmm. and get it examined and verified. It's not like, you know, seeing a 10-foot yeti. You can't catch that. It's not like seeing a 60-foot giant anaconda. You can't catch that. But you could catch a death worm.
I don't think you'd want to try and catch a 60-foot anaconda, to be fair, Richard. I think it's usually the other way around, isn't it?
Yes.
I think the thing about the Mongolian death worm is, as you mentioned there, Richard, I think there is this mystical version of it compared to what you've just described there, which to me, to all intents and purposes, makes perfect sense, because Mongolia is one of those countries. It's a vast expanse of land that's hardly been explored in the modern era at all. As you say, it's only recently opened up to the outside world after decades of isolation. And so for many people, outside of Ulaanbaatar, they don't know the first thing about Mongolia. Like you say, I mean, the Gobi is an incredibly strange landscape, as you've wonderfully described there. I've seen a couple of documentaries of people that have gone out there looking for the Mongolian death worm. And I think it's one of those creatures that when people look at it on face value and they read these alleged magical stories of powers and abilities, they kind of just poo-poo it and move on. Whereas, as you're describing there, Richard, we're probably dealing with some kind of creature that we have comparisons to on other continents. It's just that there's simply not been the level of exploration in the area to finally come across one, because everything you've said there seems completely reasonable.
It is, yeah. I mean, we've seen this before with other animals, with the gorilla. Native people would say that it tear branches off trees and using the clubs to fight elephants and carry away native girls. We know that gorillas don't do this. It's just a mythologization of a big, scary-looking animal. In fact, gorillas are particularly dangerous unless you promote them.
Mm. Do you think it's a prime example, the Mongolian death worm, about taking the time to actually look into a creature that's held up in such high regard in cryptozoology and getting past this nonsensical myth that exists around it? Because like you've been saying there, it's one of those things that there are some creatures in the world that people just have a terrifying opinion of. I mean, cobras are a prime example, because when I've learnt about cobras and seen documentaries about them and people have, experts have discussed them, cobras, it would seem, are probably the best venomous snake you can have living near people, because they eat other snakes. They are the king of snakes in regards to the fact that they will prey on everything else. They are incredible creatures that grow to enormous lengths. I find their size quite jaw-dropping at times, Richard.
The king cobra, which isn't actually a true cobra at all, it belongs to a different group of elacid snakes, but that feeds almost exclusively on other snakes. But ordinary cobras, they do a great job of keeping vermin like rats down. That's not.
Yeah.
So that's why they're welcomed by a lot of farmers.
Well, there is that. I think it's one of those things that in the rural areas of India and countries like that, they are classed as the farmer's friend, because they do such a good job of protecting the crops, don't they?
Yeah. I mean, in some places, snakes are venerated.
Mm. Yes, and it's easy to see why when you work the land and you have your livelihood depends on your ability to turn in a crop, that if you've got rampant rodent infestations, I think the best thing you can do is get yourself a couple of cobras.
But I wish people had more of a positive attitude towards snakes in general.
Yes.
They're creatures that have been very demonized.
They certainly have, all across the world, it would seem, sadly. It's a strange thing when it comes to snakes. I suppose people will always say, oh, well, they don't look right, or they look a bit strange. A bit like spiders, really, Richard. There's another creature I find incredibly fascinating, and their abilities from the fact that they can parachute around if they wish, ballooning, or they can walk on water. The fact that tarantulas hiss, they're just an incredibly intelligent and interesting creature, and I think snakes are very much the same.
Yeah, my most favourite thing are crocodiles. My big passion is crocodilian. But you'll find that humans like things that are alike to them, so they like gutty mammals and monkeys and things like that, and things that they think look cute. I mean, have you ever read Rudyard Kipling's Jungle Book?
Yes.
They're superb. I love the Disney Corporation deeply and passionately. And one of the reasons I hate them so much is their bastardization of Kipling's Jungle Book. Because in the original, Kaa, the python, is one of the oldest and wisest creatures in the jungle, and he's one of Mowgli's teachers. And he rescues Mowgli when the Bandar Log, the monkey tribe, kidnap him and take him to the cold lairs. Now, when they were making this stupid cartoon, Walt Disney said, oh, the American public will never accept a snake in a positive role. So they demoted Kaa to a second-string villain, where in the book, he's a positive character who fears nothing, least of all, Shere Kaa.
Yep, absolutely. snakes just have a bad PR, Richard.
Well, I'll tell you what terrifies me is moth.
Moth?
I can't abide moth. I'm petrified of moth. I have a phobia of moth. But show me a finished book crocodile, and I'll be beside myself with excitement. Show me a large moth, and I will squeal like a girl and run away.
Well, everybody's got their weak spot, Richard. That does surprise me for a man that chases down some of the more terrifying of the cryptozoological canon as you do. But I suppose, as I said, phobias are strange things at the best of times.
The thing about phobias is they make no sense.
No, absolutely. Absolutely.
But I knew one of them once who had a phobia of hedgehogs. She was petrified of hedgehogs.
Really?
Yeah. And I knew a guy. His name was Dennis Wheatley. He wasn't really Dennis Wheatley.
Yes, yeah, all red.
A cult mole. He used to run Twycross Reptile House before me, and I took over when he retired. He had a phobia of mushrooms. He couldn't stand mushrooms or fungus.
How strange. I think the strangest one I've ever met, I met somebody once who was terrified of cotton buds.
Oh, I remember my dad didn't like those. He didn't like the feeling of them.
Yeah, I think some people have a real sensitivity to the way cotton feels on their fingers and things, but it was cotton buds specifically rather than cotton balls or anything made of cotton. Yeah. It was cotton buds. They just, it turned their stomach. It's a strange thing. I think the last creature I'd like to touch on before I get your thoughts on how to prepare and create your own cryptozoological expedition, Richard, is one of my favourites and one that I always want to take a chance to speak to you about, which is the Almasti, which isn't far away from Mongolia. It's a creature that I think, once again, we're talking about areas of the world that the perception is that we've discovered everything that's been needs to be discovered. We've been everywhere. We've mapped everywhere. But as we've just been talking about Mongolia and obviously certain parts of Africa and South America, just because we've got pictures of it doesn't mean anything, really. It just shows you that, yeah, well, that's where it is. We don't know what's in it. We just know where it is. And the Almasti is another one where you've got a rich body of evidence from people and witnesses of encounters going back centuries, near enough.
Oh, yeah. Way back centuries. During the time of the Soviet Union, they took it so seriously that they had a commission to search for it, a government-backed commission that included Boris Prochnev and Marie-Jean Kaufman and Piotr Smolin, who was the head of the Darwin Museum in Moscow. And they sent out expeditions to look for it, and that's how seriously they took it.
Do you think this is very similar to the way that the Chinese scientists look towards the Yeren, Richard? Because they both seem to be very open to the possibility. They don't claim to know what it is, but I think they seem to be a bit more on board with the possibility of the fact that there could be some kind of creature out there. Because, once again, you're talking about people who usually work the land, live in remote areas, will have a fantastic knowledge of everything about them. And once again, as always, people will say, oh, well, they're probably misidentifying bears. Yet, the vast majority of these people know exactly what a bear is, what a bear can do. And as with certain reports of Sasquatch and Bigfoot that get dismissed in a similar way, bears don't behave in the way that the Almasti and the Yeren is supposed to, are they? They're just nothing like each other.
Not at all. It's like when Reinhold Messner claims the Yeti is a bear, despite the fact he's contradicting what he wrote in the past for the Daily Mail, or when he wrote an article about seeing Yetis, and in no way describes them as being anything like bears, and contradicting what he said to Brian Leopard, who actually asked him if the Yeti was a bear, and he said no.
Mm.
Bears are quadrupeds. They walk on all fours, so their scapulars face downwards, the shoulder bones. So when they stand up in a threat posture, which they do, or to look around, they have very rounded shoulders because the scapulars are those of a quadruped. Whereas the Yeti has these broad shoulders because the scapulars stick outwards, because it's a biped. It walks around on its hind legs all the time, and the Almasti too. They have opposable thumbs. The Yeti and the Almasti have tool use. They can hurl rocks. They can swing clubs. They can bang rocks together. The bears can't do that. The Almasti and the Yeti have these flat ape-like faces, and not the muzzle of the bear, which is the dog-like muzzle. the ears are on the side of the head, not the top of the head, like a bear. So showing the bear that has all those weird features, and it'll be a lot stranger than a relic hominid.
One of the key drivers of research into the Almasty is a gentleman called Grigory Panchenko, who's from the Ukraine, I believe.
Yes, yeah, Grigory Panchenko. He actually saw an Almasty in a barn in the 1990s. The barn said there was something coming in and playing about with the mane of an elder mare that was in its barn. So he put a load of food out, hid under some hay in the barn, fell asleep. When he woke up, he saw in the moonlight that the food had been eaten, and this great bird, upright, man-like creature, was messing around with the mane of the horse, like it was entertaining itself and playing, and the horse didn't seem to mind. And he said it was making a twittering noise like a bird and smacking its lips.
Mm.
And then when it sufficiently entertained itself, it leapt up onto a beam in the barn and went out through the shift window. But he was only about 10 feet away from it. And when we did our Almasty expedition to the Caucasus Mountains, he was one of the people that came with us. He lived in Germany now, but he came with us to the Russian Caucasus to search for it. And as did an archaeologist called Anatoly Terendenko, who had also seen the Almasty as well. And at the minute he's shooting Russians.
Mm.
And he's in his 60s, but he won't back down. he refuses to let the Russians just come in and take his country, either the very heroic man.
Mm. Goodness me, what an incredible chap. I mean,
yeah.
The other aspect of some of the Almasty reports that I've read over the years, Richard, is that it's described as being slightly smaller than what we consider these hairy hominids, such as Bigfoot and Sasquatch and the Yowie especially, which are often described as being 8-9 foot tall, even taller in some reports. Whereas the Almasty seems very similar to some of the reports in the southern US states of skunk apes and the things. It seems to be more man-shaped, doesn't it?
Yeah, well, when I was hunting the Yeti in the Garo Hills, the people described it as looking very like a gorilla, black furred, but standing on its hind legs, and a good 3 meters tall, 10 feet tall.
Mm.
Whereas the Almasty, it's more like a big one, it's more like 7-7.5 feet. It seems more man-like as well. The Yeti sounds very ape-like. The Almasty, it's got a thick brow ridge and a flat nose, and this hairless face with thin lips.
Mm.
But it sounds more like a relic hominid, one of the relatives of the ancestors of man.
Yeah, and they're not prone to attacking people, it would seem, as well. Richard, as you mentioned there, they've been described as wielding clubs and things. I remember once reading a report, I know you mentioned it in your book, about one that was so determined to get hold of some cheese, it clubbed a dog to death and stole the cheese.
Yeah, it had come to a remote farmhouse and was attacked by a guard dog, which it killed with a club. It made off with a big Bulgarian cheese. I've eaten Bulgarian cheese. It tastes like rubber. God knows what it wanted with that.
I have to say, I've never tried it, Richard, so I will reserve judgment until I've tried some. But, yeah, and there are lots of reports that they do seem to be rather aggressive, which seems to be something quite in common with smaller versions of hominids. A lot of these hairy creatures seem to be quite aggressive. They're not like some of the other reports where creatures, a lot of people say Bigfoot just wanders off. You know, the Yeti is renowned for sort of attacking yaks and herders and things and causing all kinds of panic in the Himalayan regions. And the Almasty seems to be another one that seems to be quite aggressive for what we're used to in this modern era of people claiming that, you know, Bigfoots are our friends and things.
Well, it depends on how they're treated. There's a story about a guy on a farm who stole one near a grain silo and hurled a rock at it. So it picked up this massive rock and flung it so hard it sailed right across the farm. And in the morning, it took two men to even pick the rock up. There was another one that was fumbling around near a door. The guy opened the door, saw it, standing on the doorstep, panicked, punched it, and it hit back, but it didn't punch. It was like an open-handed slap. And it knocked him 15 feet. But I think it depends more on how they're treated. Most of the sightings we heard about, the creature wasn't aggressive at all. It just moved away. And we talked to one guy who was the head of Elbrus National Park, the deputy head of Elbrus National Park. He was a doctor of geological science, and he'd seen one of these things. when he was out looking for some lost sheep. He'd seen it lying down. I thought it was a cow lying down until it stood up. And it was this hulking, great humanoid figure covered in hair and walked away up the side of the mountain. Now, this is a scientist who's the deputy head of a national park.
I mean, I'm really intrigued by these. Like I said earlier with the errand, there seems to be a lot of witnesses who are very open about this. They don't seem to be overly cautious, as we often find when we're dealing with other hominid witnesses in North America and Australia, Richard. There seems to be a real sort of openness in regards to the Almasti. As far as the locals are concerned, it's a matter of fact, isn't it?
Oh, yeah. Yes. Well, we talked to this couple had both seen the Almasti, the old couple, on different occasions. The woman had seen it in the late 40s when she'd been sent away after the war. Her family had been sent away by Stalin. And they were in somewhere else, I believe, Tajikistan. And she'd gone to her friend's house, and all the children in the house were crying, and she asked them why they were crying, and they pointed out of the window, and she saw the hair-covered creature that was once again making this twittering noise like a bird, and scooping up mud and throwing it at the house as if it was playing a game, which is a very primate thing to do. And the man, he had seen one in his own backyard, and it would be that someone was throwing a pebbles at the window, and he thought it was his son-in-law, until he looked out and he saw this young Almasti throwing pebbles at the window. So he took out some food and left it out and it ate the food. But the woman says, why are you interested in this crazy topic? And she couldn't understand why we've come all the way from England to study this, when to them it's no more fantastical than a wolf or a bear.
Yeah, I just love how when you speak to some of these witnesses, they're just really matter-of-fact about it, Richard. Like you say, as far as they're concerned, it's nothing special.
Oh, yeah. No, they don't think it's anything special at all. There's a taboo against shooting them because they're thought of as being wild men within sort of a British type of people.
Mm. So they've got the respect for them to know. They've just learned to live with them, essentially, haven't they?
Yeah.
Mm.
Yeah.
Your final section in the book is one that I found really interesting, Richard, which is how to organise your own cryptozoological expedition. And I think it's one of those things that the first real section you highlight in that is choose your monster. Because I think often people go, oh, we'll go monster hunting, but they don't specify what they're going. I mean, obviously, if you're going up into Scotland, you're usually on the hunt for lake monsters of some description, or in the wilds of North America, you're probably on the hunt for Sasquatch. But I know, as you were saying about the Almasti, the region around there were reports of other such creatures like giant black snakes and things. So do you think it's essential to kind of focus directly on one type of creature and build your sort of planning around that rather than just going at it slapdash?
Well, I think you have to choose a creature you've got a fighting chance of finding. So you look for something where there's been a lot of sightings, a consistent sighting over a long period in a certain area. Like with the Ulang Pendek in Kurinji Sablak National Park, the sightings go back decades and decades and decades. The Tasmanian wolf, the sightings in Tasmania go, you know, from the 1930s to the present day, unbroken and consistent.
Mm.
And you wouldn't get me looking for something like the Chupacabra, which I think is purely a media creator. And you wouldn't get me looking for something that was just been seen once or twice.
Hmm.
Because if you're going to put your money into something, you've got to try and get something you've got a fighting chance of getting evidence of. So on all of my expeditions that I personally been financially involved with, or if I've gone for things that I think exist and we've got a fighting chance of finding. Then the only exception was the Naga in Thailand, which was the first expedition I ever did that was financed by a TV company. It's not one I would have chosen personally, but they said they wanted to do it, and I said, yeah, because I get, you know, this trip to Thailand and see the jungles of Thailand. But choose your monster wisely. That's the first step.
Definitely. I think that's wise. Wise advice, Richard, because I think often you can get carried away with it. And I think, as you say, it's great if your favourite monster is, I don't know, let's think of something that's rarely seen, the Jersey Devil, for example, you're really taking a chance trying to hunt that down, because better people than I have gone out on the hunt for that such a creature and found very little, if any, evidence at all. And often people will say that that's nothing more than a tall tale that's just evolved over the years. Whereas, as you say, when you look at creatures like the Tasmanian wolf or the Orang Pendek or the Yeti even, you have tens and hundreds of witnesses, reports, encounters over the years where you can kind of have a hot spot where you want to kind of focus your endeavors on and plan your expedition in, because that's the key thing. Like you say, you want to give yourself the best chance of making history.
Absolutely, yeah. Absolutely.
So, as you said at the beginning, your next expedition will be heading out to Sumatra on the hunt for another one of my favourite cryptids, the Orang Pendek. So, I know we've touched on it on previous episodes, Richard, but for anybody who's unaware of the Orang Pendek, can you give some of the new listeners or people that may have forgotten some of the more juicier details, what on earth is the Orang Pendek and what makes it so enticing to you?
Well, it's a small, about 4 or 5 foot tall, but powerfully built up light walking ape from Sumatra. It's been seen consistently since the colonial days. There are native traditions of it, but both natives and Europeans alike report seeing it. There are reports every year. It lives in the jungles of western Sumatra, particularly around Kerinci Sablak National Park. I've been over there 5 times now. This will be my 6th time. We found hair that was identified by Lars Thomas of Copenhagen University, who is a mammal hair expert. He looked at it and said that it is a creature related to but distinct from the Sumatran orangutan. So he's convinced that there's a new species of a large primate in Sumatra. We found the footprints, which are different from the prints of any other ape. They have a much broader heel for weight bearing because it's walking around upright on the forest floor. We found handprints, which are more like the hands that a small gorilla rather than an orangutan, with much stubbier fingers. They're not like the long, thin fingers of an orangutan, and a much larger thumb. We've heard the vocalizations of it. My colleague Dave Archer and our late guide Sahar Dimas both saw the creature and watched it as it clung to the side of a tree, then climbed down and walked away on its hind legs. So, like I said before, there's consistency here. There's consistency in the reports. And it's, along with the Tasmanian wolf, I think it's the cryptid most likely to exist. And one of the other things that I cover in my How to Set Up an Expedition chapter is the key to it is getting good guide. A good guide can provide transport, provide food, find eyewitnesses, find out where the latest sightings has been, and get you there. Because they act as fixers as well. We had a fantastic guide called Sahar Dimas, who sadly now passed away, in Sumatra, in a lot of our past expeditions. So he's a wonderful tracker and a great organizer. And that's another thing you really need to have on an expedition is a great local guide. You just can't swan into an area by yourself. You need local guides. And I can't wait to get back out in the field and get back on the track of Orang Pendek, because the last time I was there, we got a bunch of witnesses together, and there must have been about 20 of them that had seen this thing. We all interviewed them, and they were all describing the same animal. Powerfully built creature with dark grey or black fur, about 4 or 5 feet tall. Strikingly human-like face. And we found so many tracks and handprints the last time we were there. I took some plaster of Paris, because we usually come across 1 or 2 tracks. We found some tracks on the first day. They weren't that good, but I thought, well, probably won't find any more. So I used the plaster of Paris up on those tracks. The next day, there were tracks that were dozens of times better everywhere. And you could see where they'd been around rotting logs when you were apart looking for grubs. And you could see where one of them had gone up an embankment, a sort of earth embankment in the jungle. And it had gone down on all fours and used its hands to poke itself up as well as its feet. It's amazing.
Oh, fantastic. So when are you going out there, Richard?
Hopefully, it looks like the last 3 weeks of August. We're just getting the passports and things and visas and things.
What's the weather going to be like when you go out there at that time of year? What's it? What's the temperature? Is it going to be sort of rainy or?
It's dry season. Ah. So it shouldn't be too rainy. I mean, the last time we were there, we were really lucky. It didn't rain until the last night we were there.
Oh.
So hopefully it'll be, it's towards the end of the dry season. So hopefully no rain. I think we're going to be concentrating on the lowland forest this time. We're in the highland forest for most of the other ones, but I think we're in the lowland forest for this one.
Oh, fantastic. Well, the very best of luck, Richard, and I hope to speak to you towards the end of the year when you've returned.
Yeah, well, I'll come and do you another interview about how the expedition went.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I'll have everything crossed and hope you come back with a bit of history for us all, and I wish you the very best of success. So, Richard, where can everybody get a copy of this book and your previous work? And keep up to date with the work from the Centre of 14 Zoology.
Well, the Centre of 14 Zoology, you can get the website on cfbird.org.uk. And the book, there are two. There's Adventures in Cryptozoology and, Searching for Real Monsters. You can find both of those on Amazon, or you can order them from bookshops. They're two volumes or a two-volume set, Adventures in Cryptozoology and Searching for Real Monsters. So you could order them together.
Brilliant. Well, I'll put links to everything in the show notes. Richard, it's been an absolute pleasure as always. Glad to hear you survived Weird Weekend 2022.
You've got to come to the next one, mate. You've got to come to the next one.
I will definitely try. I was really looking forward to this one, but obviously, unfortunately, real life got in the way. But I will definitely be there next year. Yeah. And I will wish you the very best of luck for the expedition. I know we'll speak before then, but I'll have everything crossed for you. And I wish you the very best. And as always, thank you for your time and your support. It's always a pleasure. You're always very kind with your comments and your support for me and the show. And I really appreciate all your help over the years.
Cheers, mate.